Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears along with you here Thursday, July the 8th, 2021, 17 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. And have we got a live two-hour broadcast for you this morning, because on July the 8th, 1941. Now remember that day, July the 8th, 1941. One of the greats of the professional wrestling industry, one of the greats of the civil rights movement, one of the greats of the labor union movement, and as I've always said, one of, if not the best extemporaneous talkers, promo men in the world, was born 80 years ago today, and he joins us in studio for the two-hour duration this morning in Marion, Ohio, and he used to sell out the Coliseum, 5,000 seats over here, back in 1968, if you can imagine that. He is the legendary Thunderbolt Patterson. Thunderbolt, happy 80th birthday.
Thank you very much, Scott. Heaven high, giving God all of the praise and all of the glory. Understanding that God has brought us thus far. You know, all over the world, Scott, we meet and we greet and we say, hello. Now, my understanding is that the devil does not need anything at all. And all of you people, you can see these last few years or so, things have really been upside down. So if we just focus ourselves and put a mind on Jesus, the one that wants to help you and yours, understanding is the greatest thing in the world. I'm so thankful of being here. Only God has kept me. And good friends. Scott, thank you.
Thank you. Tell me your earliest memory. You were born in Waterloo, Iowa.
Waterloo, Iowa.
July 8th, 1941. What's the first thing you remember?
Scott, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you that. Now, I don't want to. I was turned out there at 6 years old, man. The more women turned me out at 6 years old. Street life.
You know, I don't know that we've ever talked about it. What are your memories of your mother and father?
My mother was a strong lady. And, you know, I told you that my name is Patterson, but my real name was Gleeden. Hmm. My dad was Gleeden. Patterson was a sick man, and he died when I was 3 years old. My mother had a boyfriend, and they told me that I was Mr. Gleeden's son. And all of these years, I mean, he was there. He wasn't in the house, but he was there. And, I come from the street, never wanted for nothing.
Now, what kind of work did your mother do? What was she involved with?
I'm from Waterloo, Iowa. The history of Waterloo, Iowa is across those tracks. I get it. I got brought it with me. Mm-hmm. I got it, the whole works of it. I was raised in a juke joint. You know what that is?
No, I don't know what that is.
Well, they sell liquor. and have fun, and you know, people, workers blow off their steam.
Now, were you an athlete when you were younger?
Well, yeah, I went to school. The little time I went to school, I played football and track. I was good. I was pretty good, and I wrestled a little bit. But I got kicked out when I was in ninth grade.
Now, how did that happen?
How did you get kicked out?
Yeah,
because I wasn't going to school. I mind you now. I come up in the streets. I was sick going to school. It was my secondary thing almost, you know.
So when the education ended, where did you go from there?
I got married too young, 15 years old. And I worked at John Deere Tractor Works. My father-in-law got me a job at Hawkeye Steel Foundry, hard work. And then I didn't have enough. Wasn't that long, you know, enough to get laid off every night, laid off. Just wasn't no work there. And if I had stayed in Waterloo, I would probably wouldn't have been here.
When did the moment happen that professional wrestling entered your life?
Well, they used to come to the Hippodrome every Sunday night. And they wrestled at KWWL, a local station there. And, years and years, a few years before that, I used to watch out of Chicago with my mother. Yeah. And Bearcat Wright and Luthez, you know. I mean, all the greats, Gorgeous George and Hans Schmidt. Just wrestling was something that just I like. Kind of, I fought a little bit in the streets and the stuff, and I fought a little bit in the packing house, different things like that. But wrestling was just one-on-one sport, and I liked it. And so finally, when they was coming there, and Gus Kears, he was looking for a black guy that had a little ability. And so he sent me down to meet Luther Lenz. Have you ever heard of him?
I have heard of him.
He was one of the great guys. He was out of Charlotte territory. And Luther didn't hurt me, because I imagine he could have at that time, you know. And I kept going out there every Sunday, carried my bag. I wanted to just try anybody. Mm-hmm. And so later on, finally, I got hit at John Deere. I lost my equilibrium, so forth. And I was off from work for a particular while. And when I went back to work, I was a hothead kid. I went back to work. My foreman asked me about, were you off wrestling or whatever? And I went to the doctor almost every day during that time. And I gave the job back to him. And I left and went to Kansas City.
Now, when you go to Kansas City, what transpires there?
Well, I had went to Kansas City before. And the first time I went down there, I had a kind of encounter with Pat O'Connery, Kovacs, a kid that was with him. Well, they sent me in there. I went unannounced. And I went down to the office, and Bob Geigel, he was from Algona, Iowa, and he was good. He's a good wrestler. And he called Pat and told him he was sending a young guy from Waterloo over to work with him, see him. So I got to the gym, and Pat and this guy was in there working out with him. And that Kansas City gym has an inside track. And they say, go out and run. We get yourself together, kids, a little bit. So I ran, and I got pretty tired. And so that door swung open. And that Pat O'Connor come out there. All right, kid, let's get on that mat over there. And, well, he told me, get down. Now, mind you, I could not get out from under him. But he couldn't do nothing with me. He couldn't turn me in no kind of way. So the other kid said, well, give me a chance. He jumped on the well, I could beat him. Boom, boom, just like that. So Pat got kind of off, you know. And, well, I mean, this went on for hours and hours and hours, and he couldn't do too much with me. And that was my story of holding my own with the great Pat O'Connor Olympic. And that right there really showed me that that is really what I wanted, because I could feel that discouragement he was trying to put on me, and he just could. It, I believe that hurt him more than anything that ever he had ever come along with. Here's a young kid, about 22, turned close to 23, and he could not do with me. And I was just a regular individual, you know. And boy, when they went out of that that gym, I mean, I let out a whoo. I was so, I mean, you don't know how good it felt at that moment to stand up and be, you know, I mean, one of the greatest of all time, that he couldn't do nothing with me, and I was totally agree. Mm.
Yeah. When you came back the second time, what happened?
Oh, I quit my job, and I went there. And I went all the way down there to Kansas City. Well, I went to St. Joe, Missouri, where the Gus's office was. But the regular Kansas City office was in Kansas City, Missouri. And I went on down there, and finally I started, you know, I mean, going back. At that time, I was going back and forth to Minnesota. Because from before I went to Kansas City, I was going up to Minnesota and what they call doing jobs. And then everything was just starting, but they're scuffling.
When did you get your first professional wrestling job?
Well, my break.
It was your break. The break.
Excuse me. That was the call. And I was sitting in the office. And, I skipped just a little bit, because I went to before Morris Siegel died. I went to Texas, and at that time, Fritz was not the promoter. Paul Barsh was running stuff for Morris Siegel from Houston, Texas, and I had kind of a little encounter there down there with Paul Barsh, getting ready to go home for Christmas, and he told me, "Never mind, kid, don't come back." And so. Just so happened, Dick Byers was there, and he was very you know about him.
Yep,
I mean, he went to Japan. I mean, we talking about a wrestler, boy, and Ernie Ladd was down there in the Texas area, and he was on his way back to San Diego. You know, he would play football for the Chargers. He was a football player, and he was going back. So I caught a ride with him.
When you first got in the ring, what was that experience like? The professional wrestling.
The first time.
Yeah.
Well, the first time I got in the ring was in my hometown in Waterloo, and it's something real unique, because if they have any type of intents of use for you. They don't beat you. And wrestling is a business, just like everything else, and when you're dealing with dollars and cents. Bob Brown, I let him beat me, because I tried to be a part of. And then all of that just broke away when I started understanding from the get-go. From Pat O'Connor, from them beating me on television, it's almost, they don't do that, but they did that with me.
At what point did you get the name Thunderbolt?
That was on that trip. That was on that trip that Ernie and I were going to, went to Los Angeles. When he was going back for football, I didn't have no job, and Dick Byers got me booked in L.A. And when I got to L.A., Jules Strongbow, on the way out there, I was watching, saw the paper, and my name wasn't on there. And I come rushing up, what's going on? I'm coming this for it, no job. He said, what Claude Patterson sound like? Claude Patterson ain't going to charge no money. He said, I hear you got a little bit of fire. And he said, we're going to call you Thunderbolt from now on. Jules Strongbow gave me that name.
When
L.A., I was in L.A.
L.A. What was L.A. like in those days?
Oh, that was a hotbed of wrestling. The Olympic Auditorium there down in L.A. That's where I met, that's the first time I met Bearcat Wright. First time I met Bobo Brazil. During that time, Alberto Torres and I, myself, we were the West Coast champion. And I met Gorilla Monsoon, El Mongo. I met all of the greats. I had the opportunity. Well, my first years when I started working with the greatest wrestlers in the business. You know that Monsoon was quite a wrestler, a collegiate wrestler.
What made that group of guys so great?
Well, those guys, I mean, look. When you talk about amateur wrestling, college wrestling, the discipline, the down and gut wanting to learn, and the hours that they put in, it takes a real individual to have discipline and learn to do his trades, you know. And I had the opportunity of working with some of the greatest wrestlers in the world. Luthiers, Gene Kaniski, Dory Funk Sr., I mean, Johnny Valentine, hey man, Pampa Furple, you know, I'm talking about, hey man, Luke Graham, I mean, Eddie Graham, I mean, Pat Patterson, I mean, the names just go on and on. The greatest individual, there's great wrestlers, there's great workers, but then, we'll get to that part in a minute.
Well, you know, we were talking last night over dinner about Bobo Brazil.
Yes.
Now, what was your relationship like with him over the years?
Bobo was a gentleman all the time. First class gentleman. I mean, that's Bobo. That was it.
When he came, no matter where he came, people came out.
Hey. Bobo Brazil. I mean, hey, one of the all-time great. I mean, hey. And you know, when I first met Bobo and I first met Bearcat Wright, I heard this commotion. I didn't know what it was. Boy, but they was going at each other, you know. And to understand both of them individuals, that's another story. That's a whole nother story. And both of them was great in the workers and great men in this wrestling business.
What, because it's been well documented, in this country in the 1960s, if you wrestled in the South, they still had separate drinking fountains.
Well,
yeah.
I started in 65. See, I caught in the tail end of a lot of the things that was going on. But let me, when I had the urge to want to wrestle, I don't look at people as color. People are people. And I had more white fans than I did black ones.
What was that they would have this in the South, particularly, a segregation, but yet they would come see Thunderbolt Patterson or Bobo Brazil?
Well, that's the amazing part about individuals. I don't know, some type of charisma, something that you do that the people lack, and it's just like any other good sport or any other good entertainment or anything, bringing people together, laying down, people taking their frustrations out of, and having fun, are you with me?
Well, I do, and the interesting thing of that is, if anybody looks you up on YouTube, which can be done, to see you in the ring or doing a promo, you did have a unique way. Now, when you were in the ring, where would you say your style came from?
I love, I used to kind of dance a little bit, and I was what they call a fighter. I was blessed to be able to talk to an individual while I'm whooping him a little bit, and it's just my sister always told me to don't bother anybody. But if whatever they ask for, give that to them. And thank God I was able to do that. And I had joy. I had joy when individuals, it's competition. Competition. And then you have competition, clean competition. And then you have individuals be envious and jealous of certain things. And they act different. So the circumstances come out quite a bit different.
Because if you look at some of the black and white video of you wrestling early on, the style changed. You added more movement.
That was me.
Yeah.
That was me.
At what point did you decide, I need to change this up a little bit?
Well, I mean, I used to, my mother, like I said, I got raised up in a juke joint and music and people dancing. And I used to go to church, preachers preaching, people clapping, and joy, Everything I saw, everything that was partly around me was joy, and people having fun doing what they want to do. And my mother and my sister and my aunt, they didn't allow any mess going on, because my mother or my aunt and my sister would whoop the average man. So
so they could take care of business.
Yes, very good.
They could take care of business. So at what point did you become of main event status?
Well, I'm a very, very quick learner, I guess. I just fell in that position, and that's one of the things that some of those great old promoters, they saw talent, and they used it, and they pushed me where I should have been all the time.
When you were up in this area, Michigan and Ohio, what was it? That was the 60s, 70s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. What was it like to work in this area then?
This is one of the greatest territories in the country. Sheik, this is his territory. Sheik was an individual, was a money man in wrestling. He drew money. And Cobo Hall was the big spots, and all the big guys come through here. Mark Lewin, Spears, he was a guy from Australia and all, Aryan, and all of the great workers. That was just a hotbed.
What was the Sheik like as a promoter to deal with?
Very bad paymaster. in wrestling, promoting, whatever, he was on top.
Now, we've seen some advertisements that were sent out to local newspapers back in the 60s and 70s when you were here, and you were featured heavily on those cards, picture, name. So when you're selling out these 5,000-seat coliseums in this area, what would a payoff for that be like?
That part hurts me very bad, you know, because, I mean, you know, I just, that's when I just really, during that period of time is when I started really understanding that I wasn't getting, didn't seem to be getting quite what I should be, you know. It wasn't nothing like that, the big boom when the war started, but doing fairly well. Now, funk, I made so much money down there with funk. So I went home one time, one Christmas, and had a suitcase full of money. And the old lady fainted because of something. But funk, Von Erich, and Barnett was the pay. They paid pretty decent.
What, in your opinion, is the difference between those guys and the Sheik?
Well, that's a good question. A very good question. I don't know why Sheik, Eddie Graham was another one who was a bad paymaster and a very brilliant individual in wrestling business. But I don't know. I can't answer that question because the money was always pretty funny in most places other than the ones I told you about. And that was, I'm working with guys, and but I'm barely making my ends meet, you know.
It's hard for people who watch wrestling today, still a popular show for a lot of people.
Certainly.
When you wrestled with the Sheik, up here in this area.
Yes.
When you went in, is there an agreed upon?
Never had but one piece of paper, and it was not worth the paper it was wrote on, and that was from the Crockett's, Jimmy and David Crockett. Jimmy Crockett Jr. and David Crockett. It wasn't no guarantee to me. Wasn't no commitment at all. You come in, and if you say anything, where can you go and make this kind of money? Well, I wasn't looking at that point. I was drawing money from the get-go. I mean, God's been real good to me. He kept me through. I was drawing anybody they put me with. I could draw money.
So when you were up with the Sheik, how would you know what you were going to get at the end of the night?
Not the end of the night, the end of the week.
End of the week.
They started paying. They used to pay day by day. You kept a little money in your pocket when they paid every night. But then they all come together and they start paying once a week. You get 10 once a week. They start throwing that money up on a ladder. And what falls, they keep.
So they did okay.
They done very, very well.
They did. So, how many nights a week would you work?
Every night.
Every night.
Every night, yeah, and sometimes two and three.
Now, this is the day when people traveled by car.
Oh, yes.
So, how often were you on the road?
All day, all time.
All day.
All time, all time.
How do you live that life?
On the road and out of a suitcase,
yeah.
Eating out of a car, you know. Running up and down the road, sleeping in hotels.
Is it fun?
To a certain extent. To a certain extent. It depends on who's around you. You know, different guys. You know, you got good guys and you got bad ones. And I just a few guys that I kind of hung with, not too many.
Now, so many people remember you from your days in the Carolinas. In Georgia. Why is that such a hotbed period
Okay, well, I went to Carolina first. That's Ronnie Garvin, Jerry Briscoe. We were really some hot team. Gerald and I, Ronnie and I, we sold out everything we came, and then later on, Gerald and I emerged, and everything that was up there was, we just had a chemistry, and my whole thing was about people. I mean, bringing people together, and that's what we done. We done, and then from that, from there, when I left, I'll tell you about all the reasons and stuff. Wouldn't ain't enough time on this show for this one. But I left there because, and came to Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia. Ernie Ladd called me. That was because Ray Gunkel died on a Thursday night. Ox Baker was in the ring with him, that worked with him that night, mm-hmm. in Savannah, Georgia. And he had a heart attack or something. I don't know what it was, but he passed that night. That next morning, they sent in Gunkel outdoors. And, you know, if when you pass or anything happened, you're just supposed to go to your wife or your kids or somebody. And so Ernie called me and told me that Ann had started up the Gunkel. But I come down, and I was offered a percentage. Right? I accepted. I came down. And that's when they kind of turned, you know, it was telling me, if you go, you might be a problem. But not all of the other guys that worked for her haven't had no problem. They went back to the regular, you understand? But I went down because the chauvinistic pigs was taking it away from, just took it away from. But we went on, and Ann done very well at the beginning and all. She didn't keep her promise either. And Tom Renesta, Ray's best friend, sold her out. And it is, yeah.
And that was that.
That was that.
Now, from that point, after people had warned you there could be trouble and this sort of thing, when that ends, where do you end up?
Well, right after it was the breakdown of Ann didn't keep her promise. I mean, at that time, when I came to Georgia, Ann was in the fairgrounds. We ended up on Channel 17. We ended up at the City Auditorium on a Tuesday. They were there on a Friday. We was there on a Tuesday. We're selling out on Tuesday. They selling out on Friday. And, I mean, we were selling out just like them. And that's when the big boys, fat kids, bought her down.
Now, at this point,
excuse me,
do people offer you a position?
No. Let me back on right there. When that I asked Ann for that percentage, I asked Ann, said, "Well, Ann, why can't we? I want to run something too," and she didn't want to do that. So that was the time when Jim Wilson came and got me. I met Jim when I was in, when I went to Florida for Vince, Von Erich. Von Erich asked me to go to Florida. Florida was in bad shape. And I went there, and that's where I met Jim. And Jim Wilson, he was a friend of Wrestling 2, and it was all in business. Jerry and Jack and Wrestling 2, Wrestling 1, and a few guys. Jim Wilson was a football player, but he was in real estate, and he was helping them guys get in different little businesses, but I never could even get in none of them, you know. And so when Ann kind of, I mean, It went out of business. And Jim and I, Jim took me to Harold MacGyver. He was Union, all different textile, the rubber, the da-da-da-da-da. They was all up under the umbrella. And Reverend James Orange was running it for him. And I got a job. I went to the University of Washington, D.C., Labor University. I graduated from Labor University. But Jim and I, about time on their show, I purchased the Omni, and it didn't happen. So I made a few threats about what I was going to do, burn my old car up on the city hall and da-da-da. I went and got Jose Williams. You heard of that name, haven't you? One of the worst things I'd done at that time was to supposedly have been civil rights guy to help. But I went and got him, and he went to a couple of meetings with Gotch. I never did actually meet Gotch, because Gotch was, you know, older and all. But he met with Gotch and Eddie in Florida, and that was a mess. But we, Jim and I, we bought time on Channel 17, and we ran the Omni at 8:30. We had $36,000 in the till at 8:30. Techwood Street, Martyr facilities, Omni, all of that was packed with people. They closed the doors at 8:30. I would have been an instant promoter. And they shut it down. Kuna, I think, was the running that Omni at that time. And he was very good friends with James E. Barnett, my boy. And they shut it down.
Now, did they ever give a reason as to why they shut it down?
Did they give you one?
No
reason. And, well, see, that's the deepest, the deeper part of this whole thing, you know. I mean, they say I'm hard to get along with, and, you know, like Martin Donnelly said, we ain't going to have this racial thing because he want one. Well, that wasn't my thing, the racial thing. They have been playing the racial card too long in this United States, and the wrestling business is one of them. You know, I mean, I don't know about other things, but it's in everything. But the wrestling business, as you know, everything was kind of Hollywood. All of the movers and shakers, all the big basketball players, football players, and everything, the Vince McMahon, the James Barnett, the wrestling business attracted those individuals. And but I never thought I was being paid right, Bearcat right, and myself, and Zulu went to San Francisco, the NAACP, they found out that it was separate pay, and the EEOC checked, there's all, I mean, so many cases and stuff against them, but all of the, coming back to that Jose Williams, see, because that was supposed to be the freedom helping, but they let them kick my behind pretty good. I mean, they did not, they took all the money, give me $1,800 out of that $36,000 to pay everybody. And so you made mud out of me, that boom, just like that. And did no civil right individual, Jesse Jackson's. I laid all of it in his hand, you know, and he quit even speaking. So, you know, it's deep, man.
Now, who took that money?
Who took it? I didn't.
So who's in charge that night?
Jose William J. White and Quentin Perry. Jose William was the civil rights. J. O. White was a attorney, but he was a county commissioner or something. Quentin Perry was a big producer of rock and roll and got the stadium. That's one of the reasons that Jose went to Florida to meet with Eddie, because the first time I got the building and thing, they stopped him. They didn't even have, I couldn't even get to have a show. That's when I had to threaten going to everybody in Atlanta and all of wherever 17 went, they know about it. And I mean, out of sight, out of mind. And from that point on, I mean, no work, nowhere, until them years when Ole would call me back, when a place would go down, when Dusty got sick, I would be able to come back to, but then the same thing would start happening.
Now, that night in the Omni that this all went down, who was on the card? Who did you wrestle that night?
The Sheik.
You wrestled the Sheik.
I wrestled the Sheik that night, and Sheik and Joyce was on the board of the NWA. They was put off of the board of the NWA then, and from that show. But that night we had the Sheik. I had some big names, you know, some regular me. And at that time, if I could get on the card, we could put almost anybody on the card. We would draw some money, and so.
So when the money came down and you only got the small piece to pay people, how did that go?
A few days, they didn't get it that night, or the next night, it's a couple, a few days. What could I do? What could I do other than split it to the guys, give it to them? And I mean, they wasn't happy. They was not happy. But I had no control.
In the 80s, as far as the wrestling career, what were you doing?
80s? Nothing. No. I got a job at work for the union. I graduated from the labor institute.
So in the early 90s, at some point, you get a call from TBS.
No, I never did. No, TBS. I would always get, it was Ole, he'd find me some kind of way. If someone was down or something, you know.
But he at that time was booking for the TBS show.
Yeah, he was booking for Barnett. And see, Ole was also up there in Charlotte before he come down here. See, boy, that's Charlotte, at Jimmy Crockett, David Crockett, at Jarrett, and then Jerry Lawler. Well, see, when they came down, when they was, I guess that was a time when it was all this was planned. They were, you know, they were the threatening of the small territories, that super, that 17, and that Vince McMahon from New York. They were threatening all of the small territories being put out of business, and which they did do from those two. And they were, and then at that same time, Crockett's and Eric Bischoff, man, they screwed this business. I mean, they done a job. North Carolina was one of the best territories. Short trips, I mean, they screwed wrestling business up when the big money started. And that was the fight. Also, on one of those tapes that Jim Cornette made, that him and Bill Eadie made about me, Cornette asked this question, what happened, how they got rid of Thunderbolt Patterson and Bill Eady was there, and Bill Eady said, "Well, I didn't even know what was going on." Well, I do, and see, they were talking things that they don't know, and I was on that inside there with them, and drawing money, you know, Jim Cornette, and Raging Bull, you know, said that I was washed up. I was going out, but that was a lie. I couldn't understand the bull coming off at me like that because I never done nothing to her. I always thought it was friend, though. But that was the time we kind of souped it up a little bit. Well, I let him and they do anything to me. I didn't let nobody do nothing to me. Very few. And that's when Minoru was trying to bring Orin along, and Bull was there and didn't even know what was going on at the time. He thought it was, well, he said, well, Thunderbolt was losing it, getting old, and they was getting rid of Ole, and, you know, they didn't know what was going on.
It's the 80th birthday of Thunderbolt Patterson. We got to step out for just a second, but we're coming back with a whole nother hour this morning in 15 minutes.
740-225-4495. Webpage, crtmechanicals.com.
Hey everybody, it's Pastor Steve Whitaker from the Pastor Spot. We are on every Tuesday at 5:15 and replay again on Wednesday at 3:15. We take pertinent issues of the day going on and look at them in a biblical perspective. So we'd love to have you listen and just, you know, call in, just get a conversation going and have a great time on the show.
Pastor Steve Whitaker is the pastor at Community Christian Fellowship in Prospect, Ohio. Address 209 East Water Street. The Marion Towers Apartments are a supporter of WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Address 400 Delaware Avenue. Phone number 740-387-9050. Programs on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM are brought to you by Williams Grass Cutters. Telephone number 740-272-0062. Website williamsgrasscutters.com. Facebook page at Williams Grass Cutters. Email w.grasscutters@gmail.com.
180 over 111, and I had a stroke.
I couldn't speak or walk.